Israeli sites, and even we say the Iraqi resistance, basically joining the Ansar Allah and joining Hezbollah in attacking the Zionist entity itself within the occupied Palestine.
Okay.
They themselves are basically building up to remove the occupation from its power and from its influence within the region.
All right. Well, thank you both for being with us. Elijah Magna, journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. Julia Qasem, journalist and political analyst out of Beirut. And thanks for being with us on Another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 218 to 219. From the chapter Al-Baqarah from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizgar.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Innal ladhina amanu wal ladhina hajaru wa jahadu fi sabilillah. إِنَّ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَالَّذِينَ هَاجَرُوا وَجَاهَدُوا فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ أُولَئِكَ يَرْجُونَ رَحْمَةَ اللَّهِ أُولَئِكَ يَرْجُونَ رَحْمَةَ اللَّهِ وَاللَّهُ غَفُورٌ رَحِيمٌ يَسْأَلُونَكَ عَنِ الْخَمْرِ وَالْمَيْسِرِ قُلْ فِيهِمَا إِثْمٌ كَبِيرٌ وَمَنَافِعُ لِلنَّاسِ قُلْ فِيهِمَا إِثْمٌ كَبِيرٌ وَمَنَافِعُ لِلنَّاسِ وَإِثْمُهُمَا من نفعهما ويسألون يسألونك ماذا ينفقون قل العفو وكذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات لعلكم تتفكرون ويسألونك ماذا ينفقون قل العفو كذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات لعلكم تتفكرون.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Surely those who believed and those who fled their home and strove hard in the way of Allah, these hope for the mercy of Allah, and Allah is forgiving, merciful. They ask you about intoxicants and games of chance. Say, in both of them there is a great sin and means of profit for men, and their sin is greater than their profit. And they ask you as to what they should spend. Say, what you can spare. Thus does Allah make clear to you the communications that you may ponder.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines this hour: Israel's relentless strikes take more civilian lives across the Gaza Strip, with the total death toll from the regime's genocidal war exceeding 27,300. A Palestinian doctor recounts his 45-day ordeal after being kidnapped by Israeli forces, saying that he was subjected to very severe torture in the regime's jails. And Iran strongly condemns U.S. and British military attacks on Yemen and other West Asian countries, warning them not to test the wrath of the region. Thanks for joining us. The Israeli bloodshed continues unabated in Gaza, as more Palestinians are losing their lives in fresh air and artillery strikes on the besieged strip. At least 30 civilians were killed in Israeli shelling in the central city of Deir al-Balah during the past 24 hours. There was also a drone attack on an area in the center of Gaza City, which claimed the lives of three people. Elsewhere in the city, four Palestinians were killed after a residential building was bombed. According to a European NGO, roughly 110,000 Palestinians have been reported killed, missing, or injured in Gaza since Israel launched its bombing campaign on October the 7th. The UN Human Rights Monitor also says around 90% of the entire population of Gaza has been displaced in almost 4 months. The death toll from Israel's genocidal war stands at over 27,000. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed with our guest the plight of displaced Palestinians amid Israel's incessant attacks on Gaza. Here's an extract from that discussion.
Allow me to invite a couple of guests now for this news review. Moti Abu Musab is our correspondent. He is in Gaza and Deir al-Balah. And Nicholas J.S. Davis, independent journalist and author, is also joining me from Miami. Good to have both of you, gentlemen. Let's first go to Deir al-Balah and get an update from our correspondent on the ground there, Moti.
Israeli airstrikes and the Israeli incursions were maintained over the last couple of hours. Let me begin with the central area of Gaza Strip, where it was a bloody day for the Palestinian civilians here in the city, as the Israeli warplanes destroyed so far at least four Palestinian residential buildings in addition to a mosque. These buildings actually were overcrowded with the Palestinian people and the Palestinian evacuees who fled their houses and their residential buildings and neighborhoods in the northern parts and Gaza City. Every strike, every airstrike waged by the Israeli war plans means the dozens of the Palestinian casualties. Over the last 3 days, the Israeli occupation forces intensified their attacks on the central area of Gaza Strip, Deir el-Balah City and Rafah City. Those areas, they were claimed by the Israeli occupation forces as safe areas, and they have been demanding the Palestinian civilians to flee from Gaza City and the northern part of Gaza City to those areas for 3 consecutive months since the very beginning of this brutal onslaught on Gaza. So generally, when it comes to the Israeli attacks, we can say that the Israeli attacks are covering all areas of Gaza Strip.
All right, thanks for that. Now, Nicholas, you see what the situation is like. Terrible is not enough to describe that. This is something unprecedented going in broad daylight, this genocide and ethnic cleansing of Palestinians and all the core crimes happening there. Western leaders just sitting there and saying, okay, it's enough, protect the civilians. They're just giving it lip service, and people are getting killed so easily. No safe place in Gaza. So what do you anticipate? How many more lives should be lost for this to stop?
It is very hard to say, because we've had U.S. officials today talking about a ceasefire, but the terms that the U.S. wants for a ceasefire and that Israel wants for a ceasefire are essentially the surrender of Gaza to the Israelis. They're talking about having a 6-week pause in the fighting, during which all the hostages would be released, and then the Israelis would be free to just unleash their genocide with even less restraint, because there would no longer be the hostages there. So I mean, this is not. This is not a serious negotiation on the part of Israel and the United States. It is really for domestic consumption to their own people to act like they support a ceasefire. But, you know, instead, while even as they conduct what amounts to a sort of propaganda operation to blame Hamas, the Palestinians for the continuation of the genocide, the U.S. and the U.K. are stepping up their assaults on anyone around the Middle East that is standing with the Palestinians and trying to relieve some of the pressure from Gaza. And, President Biden has admitted that bombing the Houthis in Yemen will not lead them to cease their attacks. So these actions by the United States on behalf of Israel and on behalf of their own interests are really just escalations.
All right, appreciate that. That's the end of this news review. Let me thank my guests, Mutia Abu Musaba, our correspondent, Deir el-Balah Gaza, and Nicholas J.S. Davis, independent journalist and author in Miami. That's it for this news review.
Welcome back. A Palestinian doctor held in an Israeli jail for 45 days recounts the ordeal that he went through while in detention.
The torture was very severe in Israeli prisons. I am a doctor. My weight was 87 kilograms. I lost more than 25 kilograms in 45 days. I lost my balance. I lost focus. I lost all feeling. We were shackled for 45 days, handcuffed for 45 days.
The Palestinian physician says that he was subjected to abuse during his captivity, including sleep deprivation, starvation, constant shackling, and blindfolding. Saeed Abdulrahman Maruf, who has been released now, says that his hands were cuffed, his legs shackled, and his eyes masked for the nearly seven-week imprisonment. The doctor says that he was working at a Gaza hospital when it was surrounded by Israeli forces in December, and he was detained. He says one would not know the severity of the ordeal unless they went through it. On the ground, Palestinian resistance fighters have been fighting off the Israeli invasion in Gaza and inflicting heavy losses on the regime's military. The spokesman for Hamas's military wing says 43 Israeli armored vehicles were completely or partially destroyed across the strip in recent days. Abu Beda said the Qassam brigades also killed 15 Israeli forces at point-blank range. Dozens of other Israeli troops were killed or injured in other military operations, like attacks by anti-personnel weapons and anti-tank missiles. The resistance fighters also blew up a tunnel after Israeli forces entered it. Israel has confirmed the death of some 225 of its soldiers since the start of the ground invasion of Gaza. However, Palestinian resistance groups say the actual number is much higher. A Palestinian-Canadian who reported on the Israeli atrocities and the suffering of the people in Gaza has gone missing in the territory. Mansour Shaman had gained a following on social media. He also initiated several humanitarian aid projects to help the locals in Gaza. Mansour was last seen leaving the Nasser Hospital area in Khan Yunis in order to reach Rafah on January 21. There are eyewitness accounts of him being abducted by Israeli forces at checkpoint. We were joined by Mansour's mother earlier for more details.
I don't know where is he. I'm trying to know. I'm approaching the Canadian government since 14 days to locate him for me and say where he is. Is he with Israel? Is he abducted? Is he alive or not? They said they have been reaching them, reaching the government of Israel, but they didn't tell me what is the reply from the other side. Can it be 14 days of sending messages and emails from a government to a government and they don't have any reply? And until now, I know nothing. This is 14 days. I just had one phone from the Minister of Foreign Affairs. Kindly, she spoke to me and she assured me they will do their best. That was like 5 days ago. And that's it. They say they are working on it. Okay, what type of work? What type of work has been done? What information they have from the other side about him? Is he with them? Can you assure his safety? Can you assure them they are not torturing him? He's a civilian. He did nothing except being a human. And being a human is against Israel's goals. Israel doesn't want anybody to feed the civilians. They used to cook and bring food from the donations and distribute meat, rice, flour, fuel, build tents, and they don't want, if somebody built a tent for them, he is a terrorist. That's it. You can't be human.
The U.S. and the U.K. have carried out more airstrikes on Yemen, targeting Hodeidah and Sada provinces. According to Yemeni military sources, the two provinces saw 15 attacks overnight. 8 of them targeted Ras Issa district. American and British militaries have carried out a spate of joint attacks on Yemen since the 11th of January. Some of those strikes were launched unilaterally by the U.S. with the aim to protect Israel's maritime interests. Yemen has been carrying out attacks on Israeli-owned and Israeli-linked ships in the Red Sea over the regime's onslaught on Gaza and its blockade of the coastal Palestinian Strip. Iran's foreign minister has condemned rounds of U.S.-led attacks on Yemen, Iraq, and Syria, warning against escalation in the region. In a social media post, Hossein Amir Abdullahian wrote that he had told his British counterpart that the continuation of the war is not a solution. The top Iranian diplomat was referring to heightened tensions in the region over the ongoing Israeli onslaught on Gaza. Amir Abdullahian warned the U.S. and the U.K. not to test, quote, the wrath of the region. He added that the security of Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and Palestine equals the security of the entire region. The latest aggression by American and British forces against Yemen has also drawn condemnation from Palestinian resistance movements. Hamas warned that the attacks will plunge the region into further turmoil, and the Islamic Jihad movement holds the U.S. responsible for the repercussions of its attacks on Yemen. Iraqi resistance forces have targeted a U.S. base inside of Syria as they continue their operations in support of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The Islamic resistance in Iraq announced that its fighters struck the American base in the Al-Omar oil field in Syria's Deir al-Zor province. There was no immediate word on possible casualties or damage. Iraqi resistance fighters carried out more than 100 attacks on U.S. military bases and facilities in the region in response to the ongoing American-Israeli genocide in Gaza. The Islamic resistance in Iraq says its attacks are part of a strategy to counter U.S. occupation forces in Iraq and Syria and Washington's support for the Tel Aviv regime. Iran has kicked off nationwide ceremonies marking the 45th anniversary of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. The 10-day celebrations, dubbed the 10-day dawn, is traditionally a time to look back and reflect on the achievements that Iran has made thanks to the victory of the revolution. One of the fields in which Iran has made significant progress is nanotechnology. Today, the country ranks among the top five in the world. Gisumi Shahmadi has more.
Scientists working with special electron microscopes in order to undertake cutting-edge research and product development. This is nanotechnology, the integration of science and engineering on a tiny scale, namely with atoms and molecules. A relatively new field of science and technology with perceived long-term benefits. One that Iran has taken very seriously and today is reaping its rewards. This is all in line with long-term goals and 3-10-year plans to develop nanotechnology in Iran with leader of the Islamic Revolution Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei's full support. But that is not enough. The main strategy of the Islamic Republic of Iran is to benefit from this cutting-edge technology. Therefore, according to officials at the Nanotechnology Development Headquarters, commercializing nano products is an important step and a top priority.
In 2001, which is pretty much the same time that other countries began to engage in nanotechnology development, we established a nanotech headquarters, and in many universities and research centers across the country, scientists started doing research in this field. We started with fewer than 10 scientists, but today there are more than 40,000 researchers and university professors working in this field in more than 150 nanotechnology research centers across the country.
Let me give you some statistics in order to explain what we mean by prioritizing. Right now, as we speak, we have commercialized 1,800 nanoproducts. More than 350 manufacturers have received nanotechnology production permits, and many laboratories are now equipped with or use nanotech devices and products. But the bad news is, in 2022, we sold over $1 billion worth of nanoproducts, and we earned $70 million from exports. Currently, 47 countries, including regional countries such as Iraq and Turkey, import nanoproducts made in Iran.
Advancements in a relatively new field of science, such as nanotechnology, is only one of the many achievements Iran has made after the Islamic Revolution, and definitely one that every single Iranian is proud of.
Over the past two decades, the Islamic Republic of Iran has been able to gain a firm foothold in nanotechnology, today ranking among the world's top five in the field. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Thanks for being with us. It's bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
reviving the spirit of Khaybar to defeat the Zionists. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam, dear listeners, and heartiest felicitations to you on the anniversary of an immortal day in the history of civilization. A day God Almighty granted Islam a decisive victory of the progenitors of modern-day Zionists. It is the day that has continued to inspire Muslims to strive for the cause of God, even against heavy odds, to confront the forces of darkness, which in our own times today are a disgrace to humanity, such as the racist child-killing entity called Israel and its chief supporter, the super terrorists known as the United States of America, which have joined together to unleash a holocaust on the defenseless people of Gaza, slaughtering over the past 4 months some 28,000 civilians, most of whom are women and children. Please stay with us for a special feature on the Battle of Khaybar that was won single-handedly by the one and only commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, the cousin, son-in-law, and divinely designated vicegerent of the Almighty's last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Friday, Rajab 24th, is the anniversary of a great milestone in the history of Islam. It is the historic day when Israelite intrigues in Arabia were ended once and for all with the fall of impregnable fortress of Khaybar in the year 7 AH, 628 AD. It is an occasion that revives a memorable encounter between truth and falsehood. It is a rallying point for believers for shattering the supposed invincibility of the forces of evil. The day signifies the sagacity displayed by the Prophet of Islam and the miraculous feats of valor performed by Imam Ali, peace upon him. There are lessons to be learned from this epic episode. It happened that, with the spread of the enlightened message of Islam, people of various races started to embrace the creed of salvation called Islam that was promised by all prophets of the past, including Abraham, Moses, and Jesus, peace upon them. As a result, along with the Arabs, many Jews and Christians embraced the truth of Islam and testified what their scriptures had foretold of the advent of the seal of prophets in Arabia. Many Jewish elders remembered that their forefathers had actually migrated to Hejaz ages ago for the long-expected emergence of the prophet foretold by God to Prophet Moses to rise from being from Ishmaelite Arabs, refer to Deuteronomy chapter 18. Amongst the Israelites, however, there were some treacherous tribes, such as the Banu Nazir, who not only tried to deny the manifest truth, but also ganged up with the pagan Arabs to plot against God's last revelation to mankind. The hypocrisy and breaching of promise by these precursors of modern-day Zionists led to their expulsion from Medina. These traitors converged on Khaybar towards the north and started inciting the local people against the Prophet of Islam. The situation worsened, and in order to pacify them, the Prophet had no other option but to embark on an expedition. The various forts yielded to the Muslims and entered the fold of Islam, except for the strong and impregnable fortress of Qamus, which was turned into a base of sedition by the Israelite warlords for troubling the true believers. the Prophet wisely sent successive delegations of Muslims under various commanders so that none would have the excuse later that they were ignored. But so awesome was the power and war prowess of the Israelite champion, Marhab, that these companions of the Prophet retreated in disorder and contributed to the confusion in the Muslim camp. It was then that the Prophet gave tidings of victory with the immortal words, "Tomorrow I will give the flag to the intrepid attacked Karar, who never flees. He loves God and the Prophet, and in turn is loved by God and the Prophet." The companions, even those who had retreated disgracefully over the past few days and badly let down Islam because of their unwise policies, thought that the honor would befall one of them. On the morrow, to their surprise, the Prophet called for his cousin Ali, peace upon him, who was not part of the expedition because of having sore eyes. The immortal phrase, Nadi Aliyan Mashar al-Ajaib, meaning, beckon Ali, the manifester of the wonders. The tried and trusted Ali, peace upon him, came, was cured by the Prophet of his sore eyes, and entrusted with the command of the force. He promptly dashed towards Fort Qamus and the chief stronghold of Khaybar, and to the utter surprise of the well-fortified and well-equipped Israelites, politely asked them to drop their obstinacy and become aware of the realities. Blinded by the power and the strength, they arrogantly spurned his offer, and in a most belligerent mood sent their warriors to attack him. It was obvious that these ancient Zionists had miscalculated the majesty of Imam Ali, peace upon him. The Imam made them dumbstruck by making short work of the attackers and finally defeating the mighty warlord Marhab in single combat with those awe-inspiring words when asked about his identity. "My mother has named me Haydar, a victorious lion." And the rest is history. How the Imam tore apart the giant gateway of the fort from its hinges, held it afloat over the ditch so that the Muslims could cross it, and finally sealed the great victory that not just shattered the myth of invincibility of the Israelites, but also brought to the local Jewish population on amicable terms, without any persecution, as proof of the humanitarian laws of Islam. Thus, as said earlier, there are lessons to be learned till this day from this memorable episode, since international Zionism in league with US imperialism is hatching all sorts of plots against Muslims, as heads of Arab states with little or no faith in Islam look on sheepishly. On the other hand, the CIA and Mossad have planted terrorist groups in the midst of the Ummah, who falsely speak in the name of jihad, and whose real purpose is to distort the image of Islam and incite anti-Muslim feelings worldwide through their brutal crimes. In such a situation, when Iraq is under US Zionist occupation and Yemen is being regularly attacked, while the genocide in Gaza is worsening by the day, what is required is the indomitable spirit of Imam Ali, peace upon him, to shatter the usurper Israel. Only the recital of the miraculous phrase, Nadi Ali and Mashar al-Ajaib, will deliver the Ummah from oppression as has been proven by Lebanon's legendary anti-terrorist movement, the Hezbollah, against the illegal Zionist entity. This is indeed the talisman that over the 45 years has helped the Islamic Republic of Iran frustrate American plots, as the Palestinians are beginning to learn in order to turn the tide of the war against Israel.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified. We're the only weekly show focusing on investigating and exposing the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In this week's show, we'll be exploring the symbiotic relationship between Palestine's struggle for freedom and Iran's Islamic Revolution in 1979. We'll be discussing the significance of the bond between Iran and Palestine after this report by Latifa Abu Chakra has been looking into some of the key milestones in this enduring alliance.
It is known that the Islamic Republic of Iran has stood with the Palestinians and all people resisting Israeli ambitions in the region since the advent of the Islamic Revolution. But the roots of this brotherly love are even deeper than that. During the PLO presence in Lebanon in the 70s, those working for the Islamic Revolution in Iran are believed to have trained directly with Yasser Arafat's chief military commander, Abu Jihad. The centrality of Al-Quds to the Islamic Revolution cannot be underestimated. The proud name of Al-Quds permeates throughout this historical process and is an ever-present mainstay of the state, which has been built since 1979. Imam Khomeini was crystal clear in his assessment of Israeli intrigue in the area. Everyone should realize that the world superpowers' aim to create Israel does not end with the occupation of Palestine. They plan, heaven forbid, extending the fate of Palestine to all Arab countries. The leader of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, Yasser Arafat, was given a hero's welcome in Tehran following the removal of the West-toxicated Shah regime from power. He famously remarked that every Iranian freedom fighter is represented in the Palestinian Revolution. Thanks to these decades of support for all who have sought to protect their societies from Israeli and US domination, there are now two clear axes in the region. The axes of resistance confronts Zionist aggression, and the axes of assistance helps Israel in a multitude of ways. As Saleh Al-Aruri once stated, the Islamic Republic is the only state in the world with a budget specifically for the liberation of Palestine. It is not an overstatement to say there would be no coherent resistance axes in the region today without the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and is now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch and is a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. And I'm delighted to welcome Sayed Mohammed Marandi as our guest contributor today, who joins us via Skype from Tehran. Sayed is an academic and political analyst, and he's regularly seen on Western media outlets commenting on the Middle East. In his day job, he's a professor of English literature and Orientalism at the University of Tehran. Welcome to the show. David, what do you think motivates the massive Iranian support for the Palestinian factions?
Well, it's seen as a fundamental issue of justice and indeed of peace in West Asia. It's seen as fundamental to the Islamic revolution as well as to the wider region and the assessment of Iran of the wider region. So it's not something which is just a matter of politics. It's not just a matter of faith and religion, although it is, of course, very important from a religious perspective in Iran. Yeah. It's something which is... It's almost intrinsic to the revolutionary outlook of the Iranian government and people, which came about as a result of the revolution in 1979.
Right, yeah. Well, Professor Marandi, I mean, what explains the prominence of al-Quds in the Islamic revolution?
During the revolution and before, the revolutionaries spoke of two key international issues repeatedly. One was the Palestinian cause, and the other one was South Africa and the resistance against apartheid. Immediately after the revolution, the government broke off ties, both the revolutionary government, they broke off ties with both the Israeli regime and apartheid South Africa. And Iran began to support both Palestinian groups. The PLO initially was obviously the main group. And in South Africa, Iran supported the ANC among other groups, and also the military wing of the ANC, which was considered to be a terrorist organization in the West. The whole of the ANC was considered to be a terrorist organization. So ultimately, when apartheid South Africa collapsed, Iran restored ties. And this second cause continues to be pursued by those revolutionaries and those who followed their footsteps.
Yes, yes, indeed. I remember Margaret Thatcher referring to Nelson Mandela as a terrorist not that long before he was actually released from prison. But David, I mean, has supporting Palestine been detrimental in any way, do you think, to Iran?
Oh, well, very much so. I mean, Iran is one of the most sanctioned nations in the world. Its sanctions are being imposed on it have increased just the other day by the US and UK and by others. And so it very much has faced problems as a result of that. Of course, the sanctions on Iran are very much premised on their problematic position on the politics of West Asia as far as the West is concerned. And, of course, that includes their support for the resistance in Palestine, without which, of course, there will be very little of the current resistance which we see in Gaza without the support of the Islamic Republic.
So, I mean, you think there's a direct correlation then between the...
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when Latifa was talking there about the axis of resistance, I mean, this is an actual functioning thing. It's not a matter of proxies. It's a matter of a functioning set of organisations working directly together in order to remove the Zionist entity from Palestine, but also, of course, to remove the US presence from the whole of West Asia. And that, of course, is the historic mission of all of the axis of resistance, and that of course is something which they see is coming really quite soon, given the level of conflict that there currently is.
Yeah. I mean, what's your perspective on that, Professor Marandi, in terms of the price that's been paid by Iran for its support for Palestine?
I would say that alongside Lebanon and Syria, no country has paid the sort of heavy price that Iran has paid for its support for the Palestinian people. Of course, the Syrians in recent years paid an extremely heavy price, and the Lebanese have also suffered immensely. But the Iranians have, over the last few decades, they've been punished with maximum pressure sanctions. The most brutal sanctions that exists. They're even more painful than the sanctions against Russia, because the whole banking system in Iran is isolated from the global banking system, which makes life very difficult. But it is all because of Iran's support for Palestine. The issue of Iran's nuclear program would have been resolved many years ago. It would probably never have become an issue if it wasn't for the Palestinian issue, human rights, and all other issues that the Americans raise in order to impose sanctions on the country are really linked to Iran's stance on Palestine. In fact, if the United States were to see that Iran's position was shifting on the Palestinian cause, they would go a long way to satisfy Iran. But it is a principle, as I said, like the issue of apartheid South Africa, the Palestinian cause is something that's sacred for Iran. Yeah. And it's not something that the Iranians are going to give up. And it doesn't only have to do with the West Bank and Gaza. For Iran, the whole of Palestine has to be freed from ethno-supremacism and apartheid, and all people, Christian, Muslim, and Jews, must be able to live as equal human beings.
Yeah. I mean, and although, Professor Morandi, although Iran supports the resistance factions, I mean, that doesn't mean that they're proxies, does it?
No, absolutely not. I think this is projection, basically, from the West, because they have many proxies across the region and across the world that do their bidding, largely for financial reasons or to gain power. But the allies of Iran have a common cause, a common ideology, which is anti-hegemonic, anti-imperialist, anti-colonialist, and therefore Iran supports them, but they have their own independence. Iran doesn't tell Hezbollah what to do, doesn't tell Hamas what to do, or Islamic Jihad, or Ansarullah, or the Iraqi resistance, or the Syrian resistance. But Iran assists all these people because Iran says that Iraqi sovereignty, Syrian sovereignty, Lebanese sovereignty, Yemeni sovereignty, and Palestinian liberation, they're all legitimate causes. And the reason why they're so successful is because they have popular support. Otherwise, the United States and their regional proxies or client regimes, they are much more wealthy. But the reason why they fail is because they are working against the people. They are working against the people of the region, but most importantly, in with regards to our discussion, they're against the Palestinian people.
Yeah. And David, I mean, what can we learn about Iran's relationship with Palestine from the words of Salah al-Aruri?
So, Aruri, of course, was executed by the Israelis in Beirut just the other week. Yeah. But he was a senior Hamas commander and leader, and he had on several occasions back in 2017 and 2019 made quite long statements about the way in which the Iranian government has supported the Palestinians, that the Palestinian resistance has moved from being from Molotov cocktails and sticks and stones to being able to fire missiles at the Israelis. And that is in no small measure, he says, almost entirely due to the Iranian government. And of course, he also says that there would be no such thing as the axis of resistance if it wasn't for Iran. And so although there are some who say, well, Iran's an imperialist power or it has ulterior motives, it's perfectly clear that the Palestinian resistance have never fallen out with the Iranian government, as some have suggested over the question of Syria, for example.
Yeah. Well, we'll return to our discussion in a moment after our next report about the surprising cooperation between Israel and some of its near neighbours.
The only alternative to the axis of resistance in the region is the axis of assistance. Here are some of the greatest hits of the axis during the Gaza genocide. At the Islamic Arab Summit in Riyadh, the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and Saudi Arabia all rejected a draft proposal for an oil embargo and a restriction on the United States using their airspace to deliver weaponry to Israel. It is now known that to get around the Yemeni blockade of the Zionist port of Eilat, The UAE, Saudi Arabia and Jordan have provided a land bridge, taking goods directly to the Zionist entity throughout the genocide of Gaza. The integration between the Axis of Assistance and Israel is deeper than many know. Elbit Systems, Israel's largest arms business, has established a new subsidiary in the UAE called Elbit Systems Emirates. Edge Group, a UAE state-owned corporation, invested $14 million in Israel drone manufacturer Highlander Aviation earlier this year. The Israel police employ their airspace management system, which was tested by the Israeli Air Force. It is well documented that Saudi security agencies use Israeli intelligence firms NSO Group and Cellebrite to spy on people and hack phones throughout the last decade. Essentially, vital security state duties are outsourced to Israeli intelligence firms. The UAE also uses Israeli intelligence firm Cellebrite to hack the phones of its own citizens in a deal that was directly brokered by the head of Israel's external intelligence agency, Mossad. The Saudi-backed Affinity Partners owns a stake in the Israeli automaker Shlomo Group. During the conflict in Gaza, the Shlomo Group contributed trucks and military equipment to the Israeli military's Shaldag and Maglan units. According to the Shlomo Group's LinkedIn page, it has also supplied hundreds of food packages to Israeli security agencies throughout this time period. The people of the region should take their pick: the Axis of Resistance or the Axis of Assistance.
David, what's your thoughts on that report about this Saudi-backed Kushner hedge fund that's actually invested in an Israeli company that's arming the occupation forces?
Well, this is quite a complicated question, but Kushner, of course, was Trump's son-in-law, who was given these kind of informal roles when Trump was president and to fix things in relation to what they call the Middle East.
Yeah.
So he was the fixer. He went over to CNBS, the leader of Saudi, and they got them to invest $2 billion, I think it was, into this fund, and that allows them then to collaborate with the Israelis. Now, so what you see there is this is the Abraham Accords, the increasing normalization of the Zionist entity in parts of West Asia. It's an integration between Israel, the US, the Saudis, the UAE, and others, which means that we have effectively surveillance activities and intelligence activities of the UAE and Saudi contracted out to the Israelis.
Right.
So effectively, we're seeing a kind of Israeli imperialism. So for those who say the tail doesn't wag the dog, well, we're seeing something really quite interesting developing indeed. There, which contradicts all of those kinds of theories.
Yes, no, indeed. Well, Professor Morandi, I mean, what do you make of a UAE-owned company that's invested in an Israeli drone firm?
I think now that October the 7th has happened and we've seen months of genocide in Gaza, the Emiratis probably regret the course that they have taken, the path that they have taken, although they're not going to back away at this moment. The Emiratis and other regimes in the region have traditionally saw Israel as the path to Washington. If you want to gain access to Washington, if you want to have top-notch connections with the people at the top, then you do it through Israel. And it's not just the Arab countries in the region. This has been true for countries elsewhere and even powers like Russia and China. After what's been going on in Gaza, the mood has changed. I've been to China twice over the past 3 months on two very extensive trips, long trips, and the mood in China has become very hostile towards the Israeli regime. And especially public opinion. And the same is true in Russia. And in our region, the popular opinion has always been hostile, but now it is extremely hostile. So I think it's going to be very difficult for the Emiratis or anyone else in the region to push this relationship further, because even though they are in full control of their societies, but there are always powerful undercurrents that should be taken into consideration. What the Israelis have done to their own image and their own credibility, even among allies is extraordinary. They've destroyed their status.
Yes, indeed. Is there, David, any significance in the fact, then, that the Saudis, the UAE and Britain all use Cellebrite, the Israeli intelligence firm, to hack phones, don't they?
Well, yes, there is a significance. And let's remember, first of all, that the technology allows the Israeli owners of the technology, who, of course, are at the top are staffed with ex-Israeli intelligence officers, yeah, to access the data. So the hacking of the phones, which is done in the UK or in Saudi Arabia or the UAE, effectively, the Mossad and Unit 8200 have access to that data. So mm-hmm. That's one thing. Second thing, of course, is that this is being effectively, therefore, contracted out to Israeli intelligence. And we see the ways in which Israeli intelligence is able to penetrate the intelligence-gathering activities in the UK and indeed in other West Asian countries too. So even if we have the situation which Professor Mirandi was talking about there, that the Emiratis feel they've gone down a road which they can't easily get out of, and it's very difficult for them, and certainly we can see some of their assets in the UK being quite pro-Palestinian in the last few weeks and months. Yeah. But nevertheless, they are locked into these contracts for some considerable period, which means that there will always be the ability of the Israelis yeah. to spy on them and to spy on the people they're spying on.
Indeed. Professor Mirandi, what in your view exactly qualifies a country to be part of the so-called axis of assistance?
Well, first I should add that the Israeli regime has a long history of these sort of relationships. In Latin America, whenever the American government found it problematic to aid its right-wing allies in that part of the world, they would ask the Israelis to do it for them. And that would give the Israeli regime long-term asset relationships and access to these very dangerous people. And that the same is true in parts of Africa. So in our part of the world, this access that they've been able to gain is something that will be long-term. The Emiratis, as pointed out by your previous guest, they have a lot of their own information is now available to the Israeli regime. But being a part of this, as you call it, axis of assistance, I think is necessary for those regimes that are completely dependent on the West. Yeah. These dictatorships that the Americans and the Europeans have imposed on the people of West Asia and North Africa, they do not have public legitimacy. These family dictatorships are not popular. In some countries where they're extremely wealthy, they can keep people in check through high-tech resources and also by giving handouts. But today, as the Israeli regime is becoming so universally hated across the region, it is going to be increasingly difficult for be seen as assisting the Israelis. We recall at the beginning of the so-called Arab Spring or the Awakening or the Islamic Awakening or whatever one would like to call it, it began with a young man in Tunisia who burnt himself because of the way in which he was treated and because of poverty. And then suddenly we saw the whole region in uproar. So things may seem calm today, but who knows what may happen 6 months from now.
No, indeed. Well, David, I mean, which regional states are neither in the axis of assistance or the axis of resistance?
Well, in assistance, you've got most of the states in West Asia, of course, including, let's see, I'll be clear, the Egyptians, Bahrain as well. But I suppose one state that one could point to is Qatar, which of course has 13,000 US troops stationed there in CENTCOM, of course, which they famously used to invade Iraq from in 2003. But it's also referred to as a brotherly nation by Hamas. And of course, Hamas are stationed there at the invitation, actually, of the US as a channel, back channel. Yeah. So Qatar has a curious position. It's sort of a mixture of different views and interests within the government there. There are some who are very pro-Palestinian, others who play lip service to that. So that's a country where there's some kind of ambiguity. Now, what we should be looking for, I guess, is for countries to move away from that, either from the assistance into ambiguity or from ambiguity into a much more obviously pro-Palestinian position. Yeah. That would be the obvious thing which they should be doing and which would and could make a difference.
Yeah. Well, briefly, Professor Morandi, because we're almost out of time. I mean, the Western states that have withdrawn their funding from the United Nations Relief and Works Agency are being referred to as the axis of genocide. Would you say that's a fair description?
Yes, absolutely. It came right after the ruling by the ICJ, and it was obvious that the United States and its European allies wanted to put extra pressure on Gaza because the Israelis have lost the war and yeah. they don't have a road to victory. So it's either escalation for them to find some sort of road to victory, which I don't think is possible. It will only make things worse. Or they have to increase pressure on Palestinians. And I think that is one of the mechanisms that's being pursued. So the United States and the Europeans are very much a part of this genocide. And I think it's fair to call them the axis of genocide.
Yeah. Well, thank you, David Miller. I'm Sayed Mohammed Morandi from Tehran. Palestine Declassified will be back next week with more forensic investigations and analysis. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.